afternoon, everyone. The House Education Finance Committee will come to order. And let's see, Representative Murphy, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I move, Madam Chair, I move that the minutes be adopted as printed.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Moves adoption of the minutes from March 28th. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Thank you. Minutes are approved. Just you just take my word for it. Very good. So first off today, we don't actually have this bill in our possession, but the state academies do have a bonding request in, and I've had a chance to meet with Superintendent Wilding about this when we had a visit about some priorities for the academies here within the last few weeks. And some of their requests has to do with safety concerns on their campuses. So I thought it would be a good idea to have them present those, and Representative Daniels present his bill about their proposals to the committee so we can all be informed about it. But it is pending in state government finance. So this is an informational hearing, but just for the benefit of committee members. So with that, Representative Daniels, welcome. And to you, Superintendent Wilding, very glad to have you with us. And Representative Daniels, why don't you go ahead, and if you want to open up discussion, your bill number, just for reference, is 4088, and you should have a packet with some information on this. And please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Lou, and thank you, committee, for allowing us to have an informational hearing. The school, the Deaf and Blind School, is, if I remember right, 150 years old. It was in place before Minnesota was a state. And because of that, there are some extremely old buildings, and times were different. The newest building I think we have was built in the 70s, and times have changed since the 70s. So here we are talking about a safety corridor that would help three of our different buildings that house students to have basically one main entrance to be more secure. It's one of those things where times have changed, and now we have to rethink about how our children go to school and who accesses the school. And I know a lot of schools have already done some of these upgrades, but of course the Deaf and Blind School is funded by the state, so there's no chance to go to a local levy to raise the funds necessary. So that's why we're here, and I'll keep my comments very short. I'd like to have Superintendent Wilding go over the details because he's much more involved in that. But there's just a lot of preservation, upkeep of the buildings, but today we're kind of focused on the safety corridor.
All right. Thank you, Representative Daniels. And welcome, Superintendent Wilding. Always good to have you here with us. And we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for having me here. And let me give me the time today. Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to thank Representative Daniels for introducing this bill. It's very important to our schools. When I first started a year and a half ago with MSA, I noticed there was a big gap in our security system and how we protect our students. As you know, we have a deaf school campus with deaf students on one campus, and then nearby is the blind campus. So safety features really are absent on our campuses. For example, we have a situation where people can enter buildings without checking in, without clerical staff noticing who is coming in. They can come in without anybody really challenging them. Who are you? Why are you here? Who are you here to see? So we needed someone to really establish a central access point where we can have this person there to check and make sure that anyone who enters the building is supposed to be in the building and not have access to the rest of the building until they know who they are. So again, we have deaf students on our deaf campus, and if something happens on that campus, maybe a shooting or whatever it might be, or a reason for lockdown, they may not be able to hear, to know what's happening in what area. So we really need an increased level of security than most schools have. Likewise, the security corridor would allow us to connect three buildings and establish a central entry point where visitors anybody that's coming to our campus, parents, whoever it might be, can have a place to check in and make sure that they're allowed to be there, and then they can enter further into the building. So it's a really important part of our request. At the same time, you see that we have two parts to that, part A and part B. The first part is to basically build the connection corridor, and the design has changed a little bit to make sure that it's accessible and secure. And then the second part is to improve the remainder of the three buildings. There are other areas that are really weak and need further reinforcements for safety and security. One part of that is a communication system and window entrances to make sure that they're designed accessible under the ADA and have specific safety features. So these buildings were built in the early 70s, and we have a lot of work that really needs to be done to maintain that building and make them as accessible as possible. We do have three other bonding requests. And the second one is related to dormitories on our Brown School campus for the same reason that it's an old building that has three rooms that are considered the dormitories. The HVAC system is not up to par. There are other things that need to be fixed for the safety of our students. And then our third request is for our track, for our health and wellness, for our classes for our students and other after-school programs. Right now we don't currently have our own track, so it'd be nice to have our own that can really meet our needs. And then the fourth request is for asset preservation that will go to various projects on both campuses with the same focus of making sure that our buildings are safe and accessible, usable, and really appropriately designed for our students. And I'll give one example, one anecdote. I went to give a presentation recently, and they were talking about shooting safety in the situation that just happened in Florida. So there's a new system in place where you can have a sensor put into the hallways, and that sensor can detect bullets. So that would then set up an automatic lockdown or at least an alarm system. And that's something I'm very interested in because a lot of our students and staff cannot hear a gun going off, for example. So that would be a nice backup to any kind of communication system we might have. So those are the different ways we're looking at really increasing the safety for our students. And again, our students come from all over the state of Minnesota, all four corners, and parents really are entrusting us with the lives of their students. And so by sending their students to our program, we really need to provide the appropriate level of safety for the trust of the parents. And so that we're hoping you'll be able to support these bonding bills as we go forward. And that's a summary of our requests. You'll see a blueprint of the pre-design. Last year we did receive funding to have an architect take a look at what we need and develop a pre-design program to really take a look at what we envision to be included in this project. And this is just a concept, it's by no means a final design, but it's a basic starting point for what we would like to include and what we would like it to look like, so that we have one central access point and a connection between all three school buildings on the State Academy for the Deaf campus. So the new piece is the yellow part on the blueprint. So that's the basic overview of what we're trying to do, and I'm happy to entertain any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Superintendent. Just because our copies are not in color, a question, it looks like that hallway or...
I do have color copies if you would like.
Well, I think just you could clarify for me. I see on the drawing an indication of a canopy and then a reception area just to the left of Smith Hall, and I'm assuming that's where your common access or entry point would be.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you'll see the office area right here and here. Those are the places that we have right now that are existing, but they would need to be redesigned a little bit in order to accommodate the safety needs. So you'll see this section here as offices and then the corridor following on the outside.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Any questions for Superintendent Wilding or for Representative Daniels? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Representative Daniels, what's the total amount of money that you're asking for in all these pieces of paper?
All four of them combined?
Yep.
Well, we're past doing a lot of the building maintenance, so it's getting to add up. It's shy of $20 million for asset preservation, the track, the security corridor, both. There's 14 buildings, and I think the newest ones are built in the 70s. That's the newest ones we have. So it's quite extensive.
And Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Representative Daniels. And what's the Superintendent or Representative Daniels, what's the largest amount of asset preservation money that you've received in the last 10 years?
Representative Daniels or Superintendent Wilding?
Representative Murphy, Chair, I believe we had some roof repairs done on Noyles Hall. That building is, I believe, about 70 years old. It's a different structure, not just a it's a very pretty structure. So that was, I believe, $1.5 million for Noyles Hall. And there was another building, maybe Superintendent Wilding has a little more information on that one.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Daniels. That building is actually over 100 years old. It was built in the early 1900s. And, yes, we did receive a $2 million grant last year, and we took about $1.5 million that went to the roof replacement. And part of our asset preservation, as part of our asset preservation request last year, the rest of the money went toward other projects, and there's not much left. There are other needs on the rest of our campuses and other buildings.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair and Superintendent, then historically, you haven't had regular asset preservation money coming in on a basis. It's just for specific projects, and it's not a biennial appropriation to your academies?
Superintendent Wilding.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, that's correct. We have not had consistent money. We do sometimes get a little bit and then nothing for a long while, and then we get a little bit more and then nothing for a long while, so it has not been consistent. We were lucky enough to get a little bit of money last year, but previous to that, I think we didn't get any money for about 4 years, and beyond that, it's been a really long time. So we do not get that money on a consistent basis, which is a big challenge for us to maintain our buildings. It is a challenge, for sure.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Representative Daniels, and Superintendent, just a piece of advice that I kind of feel about, maybe that you've got to have something that directs the legislature's attention to a particular need on a biennial basis.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. I think that's good advice. Did either of you want to comment?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, I totally agree. Thank you for that. We have a little stake in the school. My oldest son graduated from the deaf school in 1999, and even back then the buildings were not in good repair. I remember maybe 8 or 9 years ago, I believe there was some funding available to update the kitchen.
I think the oven, we saw the new oven.
So the old appliances there were, you couldn't even get parts for them, but they were that old, like 50, 60 years old, I believe. And it's well taken that we should probably have some type of a biannual investment into the deaf and blind schools, because there's kids from coming over all over the state, but also different states. When my son was going there, we had students from Wisconsin and Iowa and even Nebraska, I think, we had for a short period of time. Earlier this week, I was not here able to present the bill, but we're going to try to get some signage up on Interstate 35. It is a fantastic school for these kids. But even a sign on the interstate, I've been fighting for a year and a half to get that done. And finally, that's what we presented the bill on Monday, is let's just get it done. So it's a great school. My son, just to give you a little background, in eighth grade, he went to Bemidji Public School. He was probably a C-, D- student. bench warmer on the football team. What really made me think that we had to move is between 7th and 8th grade, we did a football camp, and one of my friends was kind of heading it up, and a bunch of us dads got together and volunteered. And about 200 students came to this football camp. And I always put black marker tape on my son's helmet so I can find him in a crowd. So we were talking with the coaches about a group of six, just talking about what the day is going to bring and looking out. There's groups of 8 to 10, 12 kids all in circles all over the whole field. And I'm looking for my son, and I don't see my son. So I finally look behind me, and not even a step behind me is my son standing all alone, doing nothing, just standing there. I said, you know, we have to move. We have to get this kid to where he needs to go. And we got him there in eighth grade. We actually still lived in Bemidji. We got him there in eighth grade. So to make a long story short, when he graduated, he A-minus grade average, and he was voted the best defensive player in the nation for defense. So this school is really important. Mm-hmm. My campaign manager was his classmate. He has now got his own business, very active in the community. He has run for city council 3 times. He will run it probably a 4th time. And, you know, we have some really, really life-changing moments at that school. And I had the opportunity to go to 3 of the blind school graduations and listen to the stories of the parents. It just rips your heart out. I mean, these schools make a huge difference. So it is important that we keep the school going, keep it vibrant, give it the funding it needs so that they can help other kids. And it's very personal to me. And I'm sorry I'm getting so emotional, but it is very personal.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure there's other parents that would echo those sentiments. It's always a great thing when your child finds a place where they thrive and do so well in school, and that's really important for all of our children. So, other questions or comments?
Madam Chair, this is here with Superintendent Wilding. His comments is a perfect example of what we try to do. We would definitely work with you, and right now we are working on our strategic planning process to develop short and long-term goals to improve our programming and support all of our deaf and blind children across Minnesota. We're trying different ways to develop relationships with families, school districts, to really support all deaf and blind children throughout our state, because they all deserve top quality education. And Ms. Representative Murphy, we will come back with other requests to maintain our facilities to really match our program needs. We'll definitely do that.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, I appreciate hearing that, because I think it's very important, and I think maybe sometimes this committee has not thought that that was part of our charge over the years, in the sense that we have higher ed committee that takes HEPR requests very, very seriously, and we have each of the committees that have state agencies that take that state agency buildings and in their categorical committee very seriously. And this one has slipped through the cracks, I think, over the years, and so we should make it our responsibility in the Education Finance E-12 committee to see that this is our HEPR project. This is our asset preservation project for the buildings to recommend for the bonding committees.
Thank you. I think that's an excellent suggestion, Representative Murphy. Any other questions or comments right now? All right. So any final comments from you, Superintendent Wilding or Representative Daniel, or I guess for both of you?
Madam Chair, thank you very much for your support and for your time today to all of the members, and I look forward to meeting with you again in the future.
I look forward to that as well. Representative Daniel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee, for hearing these bonding requests, and We just appreciate your time and consideration. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And as I indicated earlier, it's an informational hearing, but we wish you very good luck in state government finance. All right. Thank you both. Thank you for being here. All right. Representative Baker, I see that you are here and ready. And I will move that House File 2378 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, but it is my intention today to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action later time. And I note that you also have an amendment, Representative Baker, so I think I'll go ahead and move that so it gets the bill in the shape that you would like. The A1 amendment should be in your packets, and I think maybe it's just addressing the time frame, if yes. You want to comment on that, Representative Baker.
Madam Chair and members, that really just identifies the split in our year that we have. It looking for the 125 for this current year instead of the biennium as last year was. So that's
correct.
Exactly right.
Okay. All right. So obviously was introduced last year, so it adjusts it to be pertinent to the 2019 year. So any questions? All right, not seeing any. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. The A1 amendment is incorporated, and to your bill, Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, thank you so much, and members, for allowing me to talk about the McPhail School Program. The music program is a terrific program in the state. I became aware of this in Wilmer with our fantastic music director, Brian Maher, out there, who brought this to my attention, not ever hearing of McPhail until that moment. Then I came down and met some of the folks here from the school, talked to some of our members, and we introduced this last year. We have a lot of schools on the waiting list, and with this, Madam Chair, if we happen to have some room in the budget for this great program, I'm hoping that we can find some for this expanding program. With that, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers to give you a brief overview, and we'll keep it short. So thank you again for your time today.
All right. Thank you, Representative Baker, and welcome to our testifiers. And if you'd please just state your name when you begin your remarks, so we have that on the tape.
Thank you. My name is Paul Babcock, and I'm President and Chief Operating Officer at McPhail Center for Music. So, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for hearing our testimony today. And first, I'd like to start off by giving you a little bit of background on McPhail Center for Music, and then we'll describe the program for which this bill has been put forward for your consideration. McPhail Center for Music is a 111-year-old Minnesota institution founded in 1907 by William McPhail. Today, McPhail is the largest community music school in the country, reaching 16,000 students of all ages and backgrounds. Our mission is to transform lives and communities through exceptional music learning experiences. Based in downtown Minneapolis, McPhail began partnering with schools 30 years ago, providing supplemental music education resources in support of school educators. This started with schools in the Twin Cities metro area and then expanded a few years ago to reaching schools in greater Minnesota utilizing video conferencing technology to span large geographical distances. McPhail's 245 teaching artists are specialists in given areas of music, such as an instrument like flute, percussion, trumpet, or it might be in a musical style such as jazz, or it might be in a specific topic like composition. Our specialists in this program work directly with students, teaching specific lessons and classes at the direction of the school educator. The development of the online school partnership program has been in response to needs expressed by school educators throughout greater Minnesota, whose resources are limited due to their geographic location. I would like to turn it over now to Sarah Gerbelvis, who is our McPhail School Partnership Manager, and she'll describe in detail how the program works and the impact that it's having.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Gerbelvis, like Paul said, and I am the School Partnership Manager at McPhail Center for Music. Like Paul said, our program really serves as a resource to school educators all across the state of Minnesota. We use technology to have E12 students connect with McPhail teaching artists live online, working towards goals set by the rural school educator. We provide direct services to students through specialized offerings like individual lessons, early childhood ensemble sessions, ensemble coaching, and unique program offerings like world music. And we're able to connect with schools using existing equipment, connecting via video conferencing, through telepresence or Skype. And we're fortunate to not have run into any issues connecting with schools and are grateful for all of the broadband efforts that affect Greater Minnesota. In the 16-17 school year, we worked with 30 school programs and served 1,200 students across the state. And in your packet of information, you have a list and a map of our current school programs that we're working with in the 17-18 school year, and that also shows our waiting list on the right-hand side on the bottom of the 12 schools who are interested in participating in this programming with MCPHAIL. Music educators are often faced with program cuts and consolidations, so I'd like to share a quote from a written testimony you have in front of you, which is from one of our program participants, the band director in Kirkhoven-Murdoch-Sundberg School District, Pam Diem. Pam says, "I was reassured that MCPHAIL's online school partnership program was not designed as a replacement for the teacher, but rather as a tool to assist the teacher and improve music education. It truly is a partnership, and I have never felt that it was intended for anything other than that. I feel like I am now part of a department rather than just me alone here. I have made colleagues and peer support that I would not otherwise have, and these peer relationships have made me a better teacher." Now, Pam is just one of 13 written testimonies we have in support of the program, and I have the rest of them should anyone in the committee be interested in reading the other testimonials. Due to the generous support from private foundations, the cost of the schools is heavily subsidized. The full program cost is $160 an hour, and schools are asked to pay $20 an hour, which is what we've learned is the maximum amount schools can contribute. And as there is uncertainty with private foundation support, funding from the state would help create a solid base of funding and help MCPHAIL continue keeping the program at a low cost for schools, help meet the demand of the schools that are on our wait list, and expand reach all the way across Minnesota. And we will continue to pursue private support for these efforts as well. And to end my testimony, I'd like to share a 30-second clip of what the programming looks like so you can have an idea of it. So this video shows the Lincoln High School Choir in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, and they are under the direction of Darcy Reese, the choir director, and they are working with MCPHAIL teaching artist J.D. Steele, who is in Minneapolis 300 miles away, and he is teaching them a Swahili song by ear.
Now what I have to do is I have to connect you physically to the song. So when you sing, I want your expression and your body to be, your pulsing throughout the whole thing, you know. So even when you're not clapping, now what I have to do is I have to...
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We are happy to stand for questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Is it Drabelius?
Sarah Drabelius, Madam Chair.
Drabelius, thank you. Questions from committee members? I noticed the big smile at the mention of broadband, Representative Baker.
We appreciate it.
Worked in very nicely. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I assume this then goes to the Jobs Committee for Representative Garofalo's opinion?
I like that, but it's going to skip that committee.
Oh, okay.
Not today.
Not today. It sounds fabulous. Why limit it to rural Minnesota?
As opposed to, Representative, as opposed to the metro area as well?
There are barriers to access to music education, MCPHAIL's tuition being a significant barrier to many, many families. The distance from North Minneapolis to the riverfront can certainly feel as far as the distance from Wilmer to the riverfront. If this is a good program, isn't it good for all kids in Minnesota?
It absolutely is. And 30 years ago when we started partnering with schools, our first partner was in North Minneapolis, Ascension School, and 30 years later it's still our key partner. And so we have 120 partnerships all around the state. 30 of them are in the online aspect right now, Greater Minnesota, and this effort is focused on that. We have a great many efforts that we're doing in North Minneapolis as well as throughout the whole metro area. And we're seeking a lot of private funding to support financial aid for students. We offer actually $1.2 million in financial assistance and partnership subsidy today to make it accessible. We're focused here with this bill on schools in Greater Minnesota.
And Mr. Babcock, and do you have a follow-up?
No, I just, if it's good, it should be good for everybody.
If I could just add, because it's good in the metro area, we've been able to extend that model now to Greater Minnesota.
And Mr. Babcock, just to clarify, so in the metro area, are you also using the online and the
We're using in person in the metro area.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today, and thank you, Representative, for presenting this bill and this opportunity. It sounds like a great investment on her part. My question is this. So this is going to help us to be able to expand arts education, music education opportunities out into Greater Minnesota. So one of the things that's happening in Greater Minnesota, and I'm not a Greater Minnesotan, but I know this because we all know this, is that the demographic diversity is just shooting through the roof. You know, the numbers may not be as big as here in the Twin Cities, but the growth rates are just amazing. And so for me, it really bags all sorts of new approaches on everything we do in terms of making sure that our investments, our state's presence is providing maximal access to those communities. And what we know is that in order to do that, we have to approach relationship building, communications, outreach, and a culturally competent, linguistically competent, inclusive way. I know you'll be working directly with teachers, and so that's presumably part of teacher training and ongoing professional development, but I think it also begs McPhail's competency relative to this. So can you speak a little bit about how you envision working then with Greater Minnesota teachers to be able to add to their competency to make sure that that gate is wide and accessible to these brand new, many instances brand new, but certainly growing diversity in those respective school districts?
Mr. Babcock.
You speak to a lot of things that are very central to McPhail, our mission, and our ongoing work. And relevance is kind of a key word right in there. And so we continue to want to work with our own faculty and staff on cultural competency and making sure that our programs are relevant and up to date as the demographics of the entire state of Minnesota grow. When we enter into a partnership with any school, we are really entering into a conversation and a relationship that will build over time. And we want to attend to the needs of each school. Each school district, each community has a different set of needs, and a lot of that can have to do with the demographic makeup of that school. So then we come back to what we're able to provide, and what we're able to provide, we continue to work on the diversity of our own faculty, the backgrounds of our faculty, and then the curriculum that we're able to teach. And we have work to do on that, and we continue to do work on that. We're in the process right now of our next strategic plan, and that's one of our central pillars, is making sure that McPhail moves along and continues to be relevant in the ever-changing world that we're in. And music has the wonderful opportunity, because music is central to every culture. And so to be able to bring all of those cultures into the classroom and to work with that is a key thing that we want to do, and we want to be really good at it.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, so I appreciate that. And just a quick bit of advice, perhaps one of the things, and maybe you're already doing this, but perhaps one of the things that the Center might want to do is to work together with the four state ethnic councils who have statewide presence and representatives from many, directly from many corners of the state.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And one of the things that we're doing that is another aspect of growing with McPhail's, we're, thanks to the support of the Hormel Foundation, we have opened our most recent site in Austin, Minnesota. And you may know that Austin has 50 different languages spoken in that small community. And so there we are working with all the community leaders and really working with how can, so if you look at some music education programs in junior high and high school, it may not be as diverse as that district. And so we're, one of the key principles that we do is work with the early childhood programming where it is accessible to every student, and then it move that along as those students move up so that the programs stay accessible and in the future may look a little bit different than they do today.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is just a comment. Thank you very much for bringing this to our attention and bringing it forward. I noticed that St. Cloud South Junior High is on the list, so maybe we can boost it up just a little bit.
Not ahead of
my
lot.
Okay, not ahead of
my lot. The fight is breaking out over who gets services now.
But I just want to say that South Junior High is one of the schools in my district that is having a lot of change and struggles. And I think sometimes they're so busy with English learners that we forget about the power of music. And I am a very big proponent for the power of music. My son is gifted in math, and his gift comes out in music. And he now plays professionally, and he does a lot of nursing homes and assisted living. And that power of music helps folks who are struggling with dementia issues feel, at least to their family members, like they're back again. And I can't tell you how many people have come up to my son, big men, tears in their eyes, saying, I haven't seen my mom for ages, but I saw her today when you were playing. Music is so important to us, and sometimes we forget it. So thank you very much for bringing this forward, and I hope I can see you in St. Cloud soon. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from committee members? Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple things I want to share with members here, and then I'll go to a question. My first experience working with McPhail was probably 15 years ago, long before the day of telepresence. And you really served a great purpose in my classroom with my students. I had a Down syndrome boy who excelled at music. That was his area. That was where he could succeed. But my toolkit was very limited in being able to accommodate him. I didn't have the tools then that he really needed. And so in good old-fashioned email form, I was able to work with a staff member from McPhail who helped me, you know, really develop a toolkit to help the student who went on to be in the marching band and continues to perform. And so just a shout out to the great work that you've been doing for such a long time there. When they came to me to talk about this, I have to be really honest, my flags went up and I was super concerned about the fact that there was a reality, in my opinion, this program could replace teachers. And my arts area is always one that's being cut. It's just the trend that has been going on. So I was very concerned that maybe districts would see this as a takeover or an opportunity to use these services rather than hiring a qualified teacher and putting a live person in front of the classroom. What I've learned is that this is really a beautiful complement to an individual in the classroom. And then I had to talk about, and I know it's not the focus, but I had to talk about Purpich Center because I think, you know, the Purpich Center really plays a critical role in staff development and arts education and that professionalism of teachers. And again, I asked them, and if you could share just a little bit about how you are a complement and not a replacement, I think that would be really valuable for all of us to hear.
Mr. Babcock.
So just to clarify, Representative Sancy, is there two questions, one on replacement and then one on Purpich?
Representative Sandstead.
My question was specifically more around purpose than replacement, but you can comment on both if you feel like it.
Okay. Well, I'll just say your story of working with our music therapist is a beautiful story in how we want to be a complement. We don't have the capacity nor the interest to be a replacement. Regarding Perpich, I've been at MacPhail for 28 years, and during those 28 years, I have worked in collaboration with Perpich over those years. And so in our recent efforts, we have really looked at how our programs are complementary of each other, and we look on how we can partner going down the road to help each other out. Perpich, in their teacher professional development aspect of Perpich, reaches out to Greater Minnesota, and their work is primarily with the teachers working on curriculum development, working on new set of standards, different things like that. Our work is in support of the music educator, helping the students in the end. Our work is really directly to the students in areas that support the music educators because they have so many different things to cover. And we come in with the specialists, as we talked about, to be able to pinpoint, and you need help. This specific student needs help. This specific section needs help. This classroom needs help in a specific way. We're there and to be able to plug and play as the at the direction of the school educator.
Thank you. Any other questions? Right. Is there anyone else from the general public who wishes to testify on House File 2378 as amended? Mr. Heller, do you have something to add to this? All right, please come down. Please just introduce yourself for the record.
Well, thank you, Ms. Lewin and the Committee on Finance. My name is Rick Heller, and I officially represent the twice exceptional people with disabilities. House File 1072 and Minnesota Statute 120B 15. Since we just had the academies here, and they apply 508 or Minnesota Statute 16E.03, Subdivision 9, which requires state agencies, they're a state agency. And now, with 508 coming for other school districts in the state of Minnesota, or shortly, I was wondering how this applies to this, this institution, if they have an accessibility policy, and how they apply 508 or web content accessibility guidelines when they integrate with the Perpich Center, which is a state agency as well. Obviously, it's a question through the chair for the yield to that question, but that's what I had to add to this.
Well, thank you, Mr. Heller. I think we'll have to get back to you on that because we're now on the a different bill discussing grants for the MacPhail School of Music to provide services to schools in Greater Minnesota. But I appreciate your question on the academies, and I don't know the answer to it, but we'll have to research and get back to you.
Well, actually, it happened before. A lot of questions before to go through the chair, and it's up to your discretion. And without your permission, this would be buried, and we know that. And I would prefer that they would write the committee. And they could copy me if they would, because I'm not here. I'm just here to drop a seed. It's for the leaders to water. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. And if you're willing to yield to that question.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. All right. Is there any other public testimony? All right. Not seeing any. Representative Baker, any final comments?
This is a great program. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing this today. I'm hoping that we can consider funding this if there's some wiggle room this year and ongoing. So thank you very much for your time.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We're glad we had a chance to hear about your bill and have your testifiers come in. And thanks especially for the great video. We all enjoyed that very much. So with that, the bill is laid over as amended. And thanks for being here.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Yes.
May I say one quick thing to Representative Baker?
Oh, Representative Baker, you might want to stay for this.
Representative Baker, I understand it was your birthday yesterday, so I just want to say happy birthday.
Happy birthday. I guess we could have sung if we had known, but. Yeah. Very good. Very good. All right. Representative Peterson, if you are ready, come on over to the testifier table. Thank you.
All right. And the chair moves that, Representative Peterson moves that House File 3870 be sent to the General Register, but today it is the chair's intent to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time. And I don't see any amendments, so to your bill, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chair Loon and members. You know, we've talked a lot about early education and pre-K in this committee, and we all understand the importance of investing in our young children. It's critical that we offer opportunities for all of our students to be ready for kindergarten, and we want families to have the option of high-quality early education experiences. I want to be clear, this bill is not an endorsement for any type of universal pre-K system, which is what the governor proposes. I would much prefer investments to be directed to early learning scholarships and retain that parent choice. However, we don't know if there will be any increase in these funds at, from the current levels, and we don't want to assume that there will be moving forward. However, this bill is in the vein of we always want to be prepared. If there is new money for these programs going forward, this bill represents a better way to use it. This bill is an effort to ensure that we have a balanced presentation of pre-K providers in publicly funded state pre-K programs. We best meet child and family needs and achieve the best outcomes when the private and community and public sectors work together. It states that the school district or charter school must contract with a 3 or 4 star rated parent aware program in the community for a minimum of 40% of new participants in BPK or school readiness. Eligible community-based providers, which are licensed child care centers, family child care, Head Start, etc., would elect to participate. If a district did not have enough interested and eligible community providers to meet the 40% threshold, it could instead use those funds for its own programming. So there's no concern for losing funding. This is simply a mechanism to ensure that we have a robust mixed delivery system for public pre-K, and again, only applies to new funds put into these programs from this point forward. And Madam Chair, I do have a testifier, Chair Sanford, who would like to give a testimony as well.
All right. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Welcome, Ms. Sanford.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have no Swahili and no movies. I'm sorry. But you're glad I'm not going to sing. My name is Claire Sanford, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association, which is a statewide association of about 250 licensed child care centers across Minnesota. And I do want to point out before I continue, we had another testifier who wanted to be here in support of the bill who comes from Ada, Minnesota, which is about an 8-hour round trip, and she was not able to get out of her center this morning to come, so she emailed her testimony, which has been passed out to you, so she's sorry not to be here. Thank you, Representative Peterson, Representative Erickson, for your support of this bill. I want to echo Representative Peterson by saying the Minnesota Child Care Association also does not consider this an endorsement of any sort of universal pre-K system, even though we're looking for tweaks to be made to it should we go down that road. We are hugely supportive of the governor as a champion of early childhood, and in many different ways, but we would prefer to see his proposed investment in voluntary pre-K and School Readiness Plus go into the Early Learning Scholarship Program. We don't want to continue down the road of programs only targeted to four-year-olds. They do not follow the research about intervening as early as possible. They don't provide the intensity and duration that research shows children need, particularly our highest-risk kids, and we feel they're really expensive and too little too late for what we get from them. So we would prefer scholarships and are huge fans of the governor's policy recommendation that those be available for all children birth to 3 who are income-eligible, or birth to 5, I'm sorry, not mainly focused on preschoolers, but really the birth to 5. And they make a natural mixed delivery system because parents choose where to use them in a variety of settings, and they're flexible and allow parents to get help accessing full day and full year options if that's what they need for their families. So on to this bill. If we do go down this road, as Representative Peterson said, we don't know if any more money will end up in voluntary pre-K or School Readiness Plus, but if it does, we feel like there's a better way to deliver service within those systems. we would like to see a mandate for a minimum percentage of inclusion of community-based providers to deliver those services. And mixed delivery, as defined by me and by MDE, means that a school district or charter school would have contracts with community-based early childhood providers to provide these publicly funded services. And Minnesota really lags in this partnership arena. Most states that have any sort of state pre-K system do use a mixed delivery system. And right now in Minnesota, only about 3% of funded districts have entered into any sort of community-based partnerships. In some states, that number is 70% or above. And MDE has done a lot of stakeholder engagement and knows that stakeholders want a mixed delivery system and has made some steps to try to encourage that by including extra points on the application for voluntary pre-K for districts that partner with community organizations. And MDE has developed a partnership toolkit to help districts use best practices in partnering. But we're still several years in, just not seeing the real true community alignment and partnerships we'd like. Only about 3% of districts, as I said, are doing that right now. So with this bill, we're really asking there to be some more meat behind the desire to have a true mixed delivery system. As I said, most other states use mixed delivery systems, and they don't happen without intention. The Pew Charitable Trust did a 10-year campaign to increase access to high-quality pre-K nationwide in the states and had several research briefs that came out of that campaign. And one of them was focused on how do we do best practice, how do we do mixed delivery, how do we really make that happen in states. And they had several recommendations. Their first one was, just as this bill does, to mandate collaboration, either at the judicial or the legislative level, and to mandate a minimum percentage of inclusion of community providers, and also to allow the school districts to be the fiscal agent for the program, and all of that is reflected in this bill. The small amount of partnering we see so far, it's not saying anything bad against school districts, it's not saying anything bad against providers, but sometimes without the real impetus to partner, it's hard to kind of get moving in that direction. So that is why the research from Future Charitable Trust said if states are really interested in this, this is what we've seen from other states is a good way to go. And there are so many benefits of a mixed delivery system where a family could access these state pre-K services in different arenas. They are more options to meet individual child and family needs. There's better school and community alignment when actual contract-based partnerships are happening. We make use of existing infrastructure in the community. There's less concentration of poverty if parents are able to enroll their child for these services, even if they're targeted to low-income students in a variety of different settings. And they have fewer transitions for young children during the day. If they're able to access the service but stay in the same program, perhaps if they have a full-time working family who needs full-day, year-round services. So all that's to say, we're all on the same team. I'm a former public elementary school teacher. We all want to do what's best for young children and their families. We would prefer the scholarship approach, as I said, and currently about 50% of early learning scholarships are in public schools and about 50% are in community-based programs, so that's a nice mix. And something I've noticed, I've been doing this, I know many of you know me, for several years, and I've been watching people come up and testify on all sides of the issue, and something I've noticed is that when people come up specifically in support of a program like Voluntary Pre-K or School Readiness Plus, the arguments that are made, especially if they're teachers, and I know how they feel being a former teacher, are about how huge a difference they can see when they have children come into their kindergarten or later grade in elementary school, and they know they've had early childhood education. It makes such a difference in their development, in their ability to teach those kids and really let them soar. And every time I hear those stories, I think, I 100% agree, but those are not necessarily endorsements of the program BPK or schools-only based education for four-year-olds. They're endorsements of high-quality early childhood education, period, which I think we can all agree on. And high-quality early education can be delivered in a variety of different settings to best meet child and family needs. So thank you for listening. Happy to answer questions. And we just want to put some meat behind mixed delivery to make it work best for kids and families. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sanford. And is there any other testimony on this before we go to committee questions? Let's get all the testifiers on the record, and then we'll go to questions.
All right. Welcome, and please just state your name for the record.
Wendy Webster.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Loon, Representative Peterson, and members of the Education Finance Committee. My name is Wendy Webster. I'm the Director of Community Services and Communications for St. Anthony Brighton School District. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Community Education Association to share thoughts about changes proposed in House File 3870. As community educators, we support schools, Head Starts, and child care providers working together to better serve families and help prepare all children for success in kindergarten in a high-quality early learning program. To be successful, the early childhood field is addressing this need for flexibility and developing partnerships as we serve diverse families with diverse needs in our diverse communities. The testimony before only indicated partnerships in voluntary pre-K. However, school districts across our state do partner with community organizations to provide early learning services. In the St. Anthony Brighton School District, for example, there are only 2 4-star parent-aware rated early learning programs in our community, Nativity Child and Family Center and our location, St. Anthony Community Services. Together, we have worked to align our curriculum and assessments to ensure all kids enter kindergarten prepared for success. And we often refer families to the other program in order to ensure that we can find space to serve their child. Although all communities share the need to support young families, each community is unique in how we meet those needs. Building partnerships to find new solutions to ensure all students are prepared for success in kindergarten takes time to develop and deliver, and this process is just beginning in some communities and is more established in others. Our colleagues in Duluth, for example, have partnered with Head Start for the past 3 years. Duluth is, in fact, one of a few school districts in Minnesota that also serves as the Head Start grant fiscal agent and embeds the Head Start program in all early learning classrooms. This partnership has also blended and braided funding sources, including school readiness, voluntary pre-K, and early learning scholarships, to serve as many children as possible. Jay Ressler, Community Education Director, responded, "The concern I have with this language is that in rural Minnesota, we do not have a broad base of child care centers with a 4-star parent-aware rating. Also, established licensed daycare homes and preschools do not necessarily have the same standards as the school district in terms of licensed teachers, curriculum and assessment, training, etc. Our local foundation, however, is working closely with the child care organization to help ramp them up to the quality parent-aware is looking for, so some progress is being made. We are concerned that the proposed language, or the mandate of 40% of new students, may not be the next best step. Some communities have a capacity for additional preschool programming in schools. Some do not. Some have capacity for additional preschool programming in non-school locations, and some do not. A mandated percentage of spaces does not take into account the variability of available high-quality programming from one community to the next. This could be especially problematic in Greater Minnesota, which faces a shortage of providers and services. A good example of this is in the rural town of McGregor. The school-based early learning program is the only preschool in town and serves approximately 85 to 90% of all qualifying children. Currently, there is only one child care program that meets the 3 or 4-star rating requirement. However, that program is unfortunately closing in a few months. If the current proposed language is enacted, it's possible that this community, along with other communities, may be ineligible for funding due to lack of qualifying non-school district or mixed delivery programs with which to partner. Like other rural communities, many families face the issue of accessing quality child care. Given the shortage, it is vital for families to be able to access a high-quality preschool program in order to best prepare their children for kindergarten. Fortunately, the legislature took positive steps to last year when they requested the Office of the Legislative Auditor to complete a study of early education. We hope this report will provide us with insights that will lead to solutions for a strong mixed delivery system and distribute funds throughout the state to serve the needs of families. We hope that you will refrain from taking action until this report is available and representatives of all programmatic types work together to find solutions that will ensure a healthy mixed delivery system. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. Mr. Uni, you're here for the department.
Yes.
Very good.
Madam Chair, members of Dosh Uni, Department of Education.
one of the benefits of going last is many of my points are always already made by speakers much more eloquent and prepared than myself, so I do appreciate that. So the department would like to express some concerns about establishing a fixed designated amount for slots that would have to be mixed delivery for any expansion or new programming. This would actually start for the next fiscal year, and as many of you probably know, we're currently going over applications right now that districts have submitted for their programming. I would just like to note that since mixed delivery was encouraged in statute last year, as was mentioned by Ms. Sanford, we have engaged in several areas to try to increase that type of activity. First, we increased the amount of points that a district or charter could get for engaging in a mixed delivery program, so that bumps them up a little bit higher in the priority list in the rankings. Second, we've engaged in some pretty extensive stakeholder engagement or participant engagement and technical assistance around how to implement mixed delivery systems to really encourage that. So the commissioner and staff are very much behind these innovative models that work best for communities, but that's really the point, is what works best for the community. What we see here is a threshold of 40% that may be above and beyond what some communities are able to muster. I think, as was mentioned, we have the question about what is the availability around those community partners that can provide those slots to meet that 40% threshold. We've also seen that if there's an expansion of just 4 kids or 10 kids in a program to meet the local local growth in a small community, would a district or charter that has a growth in 10 students then have to create a program for 4 students, or would then they then say, well, let's put 10 or 15 or 20, and then we have a whole new set of issues that may not work for that particular community based on the requirement of having 40%. I would like to note that since the encouragement of mixed delivery has been a statute, we saw last rotation, we saw 19 applications for mixed delivery, and I believe 6 were approved. And then this time around, we're in the middle of the applications. We've got 30 applications. That's over 10% of the applications right now are for mixed delivery systems. That is growth. Obviously, it's, as Ms. Sanford pointed out, it's not a huge number, but that is growth. We do believe that one of the reasons we're not seeing more growth in mixed delivery from this current cycle of funding is because it's a limited 2-year funding. I think that districts aren't going to engage, or district and charters aren't going to engage in these innovative models of community partnership where the community partners would have to adhere to all the requirements under statute, so that may be above and beyond what they're already set out to do for a partnership that may only last 1 or 2 years. I think we've seen growth with our with our technical assistance, but I think if we had more ongoing funding, as the governor has proposed, I think possibly with renewals and asks for expansions, if we see any fluctuations there, we would probably see more requests for mixed delivery systems. We'd also have the opportunity at the department to grow our ability for technical assistance around mixed delivery. So I think at this time, I think at best, we would say that the requirement of having a mixed delivery threshold of 40% or any percent is premature. I think we need to see this model mature and see how our technical assistance and the point system have an impact going on for this program.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Oney. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Yeah, Mr. Heller, no, not right now. Let's go to committee questions, and then we'll come back. So, Mr. Oney and Ms. Webster, you might want to stick close just in case members have questions for you. Could be for anybody who's testifying. Representative Sansa, did you have your hand up? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is for Representative Peterson, and I apologize.
Ms. Sanford.
Ms. Sanford, I apologize for missing your name. So I think we probably just heard kind of the, from everyone, kind of the gist of the issue before us. So my question is, there's like 3 questions actually, but they're all connected. One is, and I like the idea of collaboration. I even like the idea of pushing systems to collaborate. I want to make sure our metrics are right, and I want to make sure that we're, you know, not just wistfully, you know, forcing collaboration where it isn't going to work, you know, so it should work. So the first question is, what's magical about the 40%? The second question is, in constructing this this approach, did you, you know, assess what the capacity issues are in a greater field in terms of being able to being able to assess what an impact of the 40% would be? I mean, I do get that there are financial thresholds that any institution needs to meet, and where 40% might be doable for one, it may not be doable for another. So I think what this committee ought to know is, you know, what is the capacity out there, if that's where we're going to set the, you know, the trigger for that. And then I have one other question after that.
Who wants to take a crack at that one? Ms. Sanford?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Mariani. Nothing magic about 40%. Honestly, 40%, different states use different levels. 40% was basically a starting point to say we want this to be a good faith effort that not the public schools and not the private community gets a hugely imbalanced share, that we want it to be truly shared collaboration. So there's nothing magic about 40. It could be a lot of different numbers, but that was our intent in starting at 40. I wish I had something magical, but sorry. In terms of did we survey capacity in the field, that was your second question, correct? Mm-hmm. We did not, and I feel like there have been a lot of concerns raised about what if a community doesn't have eligible 3- and 4-star rated early childhood providers. And we want to quell discomfort with that, and we can certainly, you know, tweak language in the bill to make that more clear if we need to. But if a community does not have enough currently eligible and interested, you know, the providers would have to elect to want to participate in the mixed delivery system, the community providers. They wouldn't be told, you must do this. So if they were eligible and interested, they would apply to the school district to share this money. And if there weren't enough of those providers, the school district would keep the money. It wouldn't make the school district ineligible. The school district would then be able to continue as they do now, providing the VPK services within the district as they saw fit. Or, you know, if they couldn't meet the 40% because of community capacity, but they could meet 20% or something like that. If they could demonstrate, you know, this is currently in the community, the capacity we have and what we're able to meet, it could work that way.
Well, Madam Chair, and obviously part of why we have hearings is so that we get the intent out, you know. And so you identified an intent here that currently is not in the bill, but obviously we've got some time to, you know, to accommodate that perhaps if it's our wisdom to move forward with this. The issue of capacity to me, however, is a two-way capacity issue. So we heard about the availability of 3- and 4-star, you know, providers, but it seems to me that there may be capacity issues relative to school districts and charters, and so that's why I talked about threshold numbers. You know, you put together a finance model that assumes X number of students in order to maintain a certain staff ratio that meets some kind of quality standard. So that's what I'm getting at. You know, and it seems to me that part of what we're being asked to do, unless we have a real strong feel for what that capacity reality is relative to, you know, both these delivery systems, is we're taking a leap of faith here about, you know, potentially, which could potentially create some problems out there. And so it seems to me that some kind of flexibility, if we're going to go down this route, needs to be built in. And part of, I think, what we would need as a committee to feel good, confident about, you know, good public policy, is a quantitative, you know, assessment of what is out there in terms of the capacity issue both ways. But I'll get to my third question because others have questions as well. And Representative Peterson, I know it's not in this bill, but we heard from Mr. Uni here that that surmising that one of the that you know so there's been some growth in mixed delivery proposals. Certainly not anything that's just jumping through the roof here. However, he surmised that one of the issues in terms of that may be impeding a mixed delivery set of arrangements out there is the limitation that we've placed by the nature of the appropriations here. So I guess my question to you is, why not offer that proposal? And you, just your thoughts. And I sincerely ask that question. It's not trying to be, you know, a gotcha question, but it seems to me that if we're trying to get at this issue of you know, what's impeding a mixed delivery system, then perhaps, you know, the answer is we're impeding it, and perhaps we ought to be proposing, you know, something much more stable that people can, you know, whether they're at a 3 or 4 star or district or charter, can hang their hat on with confidence and then build confidently.
Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mariani. I think you bring up a really important point, and I know Representative Sandstead and I serve on the Child Care Access and Affordability Committee, and we heard quite a bit of testimony from providers and some of the programs, and you're right, there, some of these things have been happening because of what we have been doing, but along with sustainable funding, which I agree is a pretty valid concern from an education standpoint, and to be honest, I'm not so sure this body was fully supportive of the VPK and understanding that's one-time funding, and are you sure you want to start a program that you don't know the funding future of it? And so that set aside, the testimony that we received were, as much as it's encouraged that school districts should collaborate with these providers, some of them were great partners that we've heard in some school districts, and others were not. And the outcome was, is parents were like going, well, I can go to this place for free, or I can pay to go over here. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out where parents really felt that they had to go, or where they could afford to go. And so we've seen provider after provider go out of business. And, I mean, there have been many testimonies of tears in talking about how voluntary preschool has really just destroyed the model that they're that's where you make money is with the four-year-old. So if we're going to value different types of systems, we can't just create programs that are just going to make them go out of business either. And this isn't what this bill is about. I just want to make sure we don't go down that rabbit hole. This bill is about doing what's best for kids and empowering parents for choice and offering flexibility. And I think that, you know, that's why I appreciate you bringing out what the intent of the bill is. And from my viewpoint, that is the intent of the bill. I think that there's some things that we can do to clarify language, some of the items that you mentioned, and how we can do a better job of encouraging school districts to make sure it works in their community, and maybe, you know, having set goals in there is too stringent. But on the other hand, we already have encourage, and it's not necessarily happening. So what I guess I'm reaching out to my colleagues here and others, how do we make that happen so it makes sense and we are best serving the needs of our students?
Yeah. And Representative Sandstead, did you have a question or comment?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have lots of questions, and first I want to say thank you. I just really appreciate the conversation, and this is really a complex issue, and it's we'd like to think it's just talking about early childhood, but it really trickles down into so many other areas, so I recognize that. But to the specifics of this bill, the data that I've looked at has shown that kids typically do better when their pre-K experience is aligned with curriculum.
So my question is, what is this bill doing to basically show that alignment or serve in the best interest of the child through some kind of alignment?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chair Lewin. Representative Sandstead. I think that's why the requirement is 3- and 4-star parent aware rated programs. They are, you know, they should be aligned with that curriculum based information, and, you know, and I'll let Representative Ms. Sanford expand on that response.
Ms. Sanford.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm so sorry. I just so rudely interrupted you. Sorry.
It's okay.
Just adding to that, yes, that's why the requirement is for 3- and 4-star parent-aware rated providers, because all early childhood providers, parent-aware rated providers, have to align to the early childhood indicators of progress, which are set at the state level. Those are the same indicators of progress standards that public schools use, that other schools use. While there might be differences in specific curriculum between one district to another or so on and so forth, the end goals are the same and are aligned from birth onward. So that would be my response to that.
Okay, Ms. Sandstead. Thank you. Then my next question is, what authority would a school district have or hold to assure the quality and coordination with, like, community providers, if any?
Yeah. Ms. Sanford?
Madam Chair, Representative Sandstead, that, I think, can be, obviously there would need to be an application process so that providers could apply to districts to share this funding, and that's the kind of thing that can be worked out in the contracts. What kind of shared professional development will we have? What kind of shared transition from pre-K to kindergarten will we have? What kind of shared family involvement programs will we have? That can be done on a local level. I think there probably should be some, you know, written understanding of things like that so that there is the best alignment between community-based providers and the school districts or charter schools.
Simpson said, I apologize, I have so many questions, but I'm going to keep them coming here. And I know this is a really hard question to ask, and it's a very direct question, but I mean it sincerely when I say, how important do you feel it is to put a licensed educator before children? In front of children.
Representative Peterson, Sanford,
Chair Loon, and Representative Sanford. In my opinion, I mean, what age group are you talking about?
Early childhood.
I think the important thing is that we have quality teachers in front of our, that are educating our students. But I'm going to, I don't know if necessarily, I understand that fine, you have a level of threshold, but now we have a tiered licensure system recognizing that being a good teacher can maybe look different. So it's hard to just say must be X. You know? And Ms. Sanford.
Ms. Sanford.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Please, someone correct me if I'm wrong, but currently I don't believe a licensed teacher is a requirement in voluntary pre-K, whether it's in a public school or not. So that's one thing. And number two, I'm a former licensed elementary school teacher. I know you're a teacher, many friends among teachers. In early childhood, there is no research that I know of that links a teaching license to better outcomes for children. There is research that links a bachelor's degree or an associate's degree to better outcomes for children. And obviously, in most cases, you have to have a bachelor's degree in order to get your teaching license, so it's hard to tease those apart. But specifically in early childhood, there is no research that shows that a licensed teacher in the birth to 5 years equates to higher outcomes.
I'm Representative Sandstead. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just moving forward, I'd actually like to see maybe a little more work done in that area to see if there is some evidence that supports that one way or the other. Kind of a comment before, I think one of the things that I'm very concerned about is probably not intended through this bill, but I think this becomes a real issue of maybe rural metro, as I think Ms. Weber had mentioned before, and it certainly is the case in the district that I represent. In my district, there are not there are very few three- and four-star rated centers, home daycare centers, providers like that. And we have a tremendous shortage of child care in my area. Those that are still in existence are less inclined to get a three- or four-star rating because they're finding it's a little cost prohibitive. There's less bang for the buck. I mean, they're paying to go through this process and become rated, and they're not really seeing the benefits of it. So the providers that are in existence, which is all, you know, very limited right now, fewer and fewer are going after this rating. In my district alone, if this funding weren't to come through, there's over 100 students that I've kind of done some search on that would not be in a program. And that leaves the question of where do 100 children go? Do they leave these programs and try to go into daycare centers or to home providers, which are in a shortage? There's probably not the space for them. Do parents make the decision to not work and stay home with their children instead? And this is the trickle-down that I just want to kind of shed a light on. And this is how it plays out in my community. So we have a tremendous opportunity gap for many of our students. In mine, like I said, in my district, we're talking of over 100 students or 100 children. There's a shortage of daycare. In my area, we have a workforce shortage, which is another real problem. So parents have to decide, what do we do? If they make the decision to stay home, many of those families are now going to start drawing on more public assistance. And again, we're just seeing this decline in the existing centers for people to get the rating, the three- and four-star rating. And in your bill, line 3.9 to 3.13, it's talking specifically about districts, you know, partnering with somebody. And my question that I wrote in the margin is, okay, what if there isn't one? Then what happens? And I understand very much where you're going, and I really appreciate just the scope that you're looking at this through, but I'm really concerned. Like, this is going to have a significant impact on rural communities, I think, that are facing the same kind of situation that my district is facing. And I don't know where to go from there. So I appreciate any comments on that. Oh, one other thing I want to say. You had made the comment earlier about when families have the choice between putting their child in a program that they don't have to pay for versus a program that they do have to pay for or maybe can afford to pay for, you know, the choice seemed obvious to you, and that's really having an impact on child care workers. I think it's equally important to say I don't think that's been the only devastating thing to family child care or different child care providers. I really just want to say I really think the CCAP funding at the rate that it's at has had a significant thing. So if we're really looking to kind of give families choices and options, we really need to look at that issue, and it's not under the scope of this committee, but we really need to look at that because we can't have one without the other. So,
thank you. I've got Representative Marquardt on the list yet, and I do need to turn to our last bill today at 2:30 because we have to send that to another committee who wants to see it. So, Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And this has, I guess, been brought up before, but I, as this bill moves forward, I hope you make it very clear for those, because it's not in the bill right now, that if there isn't the capacity, and we're going to see, especially rural Minnesota, that, you know, there's an exemption or whatever. Because I do think last year we actually increased the length of time that in rural Minnesota that you'd be required to have a three- or four-star rating to get there. Yeah, so you're actually, I mean, so even what we did last year kind of exasperates that problem. And then the other question I have, you know, I support a mixed delivery system. I also support parental control. So let's say you've got a district with 100 new students coming into voluntary pre-K. And so it would be 60-40, let's say. But let's say the parents come in and only 30 want to select to go in to the contract. So you got 70-30. What happens at that point? Are 10, I mean, parents have chosen, this is what I want to do. Does this impact the school's funding? Or what happens to those 10 that are above the 60? What happens in that case?
Ms. Sanford and Representative Peterson?
That's yours.
Madam Chair, Representatives, this is because I interrupted her earlier. I think, and we don't disagree that, and to Representative Sandstead's point as well, we would like to strengthen the language in the bill. We're actually already working on that on the Senate side to make even clearer that this does not make a district ineligible for these funds if they don't have the community capacity. The district would still get the money and provide the services itself. So it's not, we in no way want to harm any community or cut off options for communities in that sense. And again, it's only for new money. It's not for the current levels of voluntary pre-K and school readiness funding. It would only be for new money that went in. So we're not taking money away from programs that schools are already using. To your question about if we have 100 kids and it goes 60-40, I don't think I have a great answer to that. I mean, in my heart, my answer, and we would have to figure out how to do this logistically, in my heart, the answer is, well, we're not going to force a parent to go to a program they don't want to go to, you know. So if someone says, sorry, we've already got our 40 spots and we can't have a 41st or whatever, you have to go over here, we don't agree with that. We'd have to figure out logistically, maybe look more at some other models in other states, because I'm sure they've run into that, how they handle those situations, because nobody wants to be telling a family, sorry, you have to go X, Y, or Z.
So, well, thank you for that. And last comment, Madam Chair, it does, you know, it's parental choice, it's education, it's the economics, you know, that all kind of getting meshed into one. And right now what's happening, it seems to be an either-or situation. That tends to be a lot of debate. But I think we could get to a win-win in both cases where parents have the choice. We need to beef up the child care, and if it's a CCAP or even other incentives out there, we've got to be more creative. But we can't pit public education with child care centers. That it puts parents right in the middle unfairly. And so I don't know what the answer is, but we've got to beef, you know, the child care idea up, and that, you know, so parents still have the choice. So thank you.
And members, this is a really good discussion. I have several questions myself, but I'm going to hold my tongue because I really would like to get to the last bill on the agenda today. But Representative Marquardt, just quickly, I would say part of the problem became how we grew up the system of directing money to specific providers as opposed to keeping it in a scholarship that was ultimately controlled by parents. And unfortunately, now we're in the situation where if we direct money to a provider that we ask them to share, it becomes a problem. I think maybe a bit of the, I'm wondering about the schools with the funding that was for one biennium only. It would seem to me it would make more sense to go to a community partner than to bring in or to start up a new program with the classroom requirements and space demands for 2 years. It would be, in my mind, a better situation for schools to consult with community partners in that situation. But I'll need to talk to more experts about that and to the department about that situation to know more. So with that, we're laying your bill over for today, and I thank you for the discussion, and thanks very much to all of our testifiers.
All right, Representative Loon, well, good afternoon, and good to have you on the other end here, hear about your bill. So Representative Loon, legislative auditor requested to compare revenue generation and spending between school districts and charter schools and report required. Representative Lou moves that House File 3600 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
Yes.
Representative Lou.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, and yes, State Government Finance would like to see this bill, so that's why I want to make sure we get it heard so we can have it referred to them. House File 3600 was brought to me as a suggestion from educators, but it dovetails very nicely with what is required under the new federal law, the Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA, which we discussed some in this committee, that states are required now to publish online per pupil spending for each school and district in the state, so not just the district, and that those expenditures must be broken down by the funding source, federal, state, and local. And so to meet those requirements will depend partly on how we categorize and we track revenues and expenditures at the school level. And we've had some hearings about transparency and reporting of, you know, when we have funding streams dedicated to reaching or providing additional resources for students for specific purposes, maybe for English language learners or for students that are low income through our compensatory revenue. We try to drill down on those expenditures and find out whether or not it's reaching the students and how we're reporting that to the public. And I think it's important for the public to know, but also for policymakers. Sometimes these questions are a little difficult for us to discern. So this bill is in response to that desire for transparency for that type of information. And again, a group of teachers represented by Educators for Excellence brought me the idea of requesting that the Office of Legislative Auditor do a study on how students generate revenues in their districts and how that revenue is spent and reported by individual school. And so I think maybe it's best to have them tell you about their idea, and I was happy to author it.
All right, Ms. Edison.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Loon. My name is Madeline Edison, and I am the Executive Director of Educators for Excellence in Minnesota. And our members, our teacher members, work in metro area schools, and each year they select issues that we generate policy recommendations upon. And this year, one of their chosen topics was equitable school funding and resources. And they published the policy report you have in front of you that includes recommendations for equitable school funding, transparency of funding, and recommendations to make sure that we have adequate funding for the students who have the greatest needs in particular. One of the questions this paper sought to address was, where is our education funding currently being spent? Is it being spent equitably? And to what end? To what results? And what became evident in the process of them doing research is that there are currently not clear answers to these questions, and therefore we need more transparency on how these things are reported. A few things were clear. As I mentioned in my last testimony when I was here, Minnesota does have a very laudable progressive funding formula in which the state provides more funding per pupil to districts that are districts and schools serving higher populations, special education students, English learners, and students who are living in poverty. And we should protect this and add more funding when we can. At the same time, we also need to know where the money that we are currently allocating is going and if it is reaching the students for whom the dollars are intended. The reason this matters is that intra-district inequities in particular, the differences between how resources are allocated within a single school district between schools, can be masked by a few practices, such as using a district average teacher salary rather than the actual teacher salary that is generated at the school building. And so to the original question, we're left with an unclear picture of if the students who are generating the funding at the state level are actually getting everything that they need at the school level. And some folks will say to this question, well, we already know things are inequitable. And that's potentially true, but we don't really know. For example, some activists and our members would say that students with higher needs may be, in fact, subsidizing schools in more affluent areas because students with greater needs generate more funds that go to the district, but then the district, because of how average teacher salaries are used, the budget goes to salaries across the board rather than to those specific schools. That's one potential, but then others would say that schools with the greater needs also benefit from smaller class sizes, more support staff, counselors, those kind of things that are added after the salaries are allocated. And both of those things could be true. The problem is we don't actually know which statements are true because of how these budgets are reported. Another question you may ask is, but isn't this already reported? And the answer is yes. State level revenue and expenditures are reported to NDE, and they are posted on the website. But when our teachers dug into the available data, and some of them went in and just typed in their own school to pull up the data, they found inconsistencies across how schools were reporting the information. Some schools didn't have the information reported about revenues and expenditures. Others were clearly using district average calculations rather than the actual figures for salaries. In addition, there is a little context provided with that data that's reported out, making it difficult to compare similarly situated schools or to draw conclusions about whether the students in those buildings are actually getting the funding they need. Additionally, there isn't a report right now that is publicly accessible to families and communities that captures these total revenues, which also include local levies and other funding such as philanthropic or PTA funding, so we get a clear picture of all of the revenues that are going to a school and how they add up. A final question you might ask is, why do we need the OLA to study this, and why now? And the answer to that is that, as Representative Bloom mentioned, this is an urgent question because of the Every Student Succeeds Act. In federal law and now in our state plan, we will be required to report out actual revenues and expenditures at the school level per pupil. We need this data available before the summer of 2019, which is the deadline for when that needs to be reported. And if we conduct an OLA audit now, we can get timely, accurate data about how schools currently calculate their revenues and expenditures for public reporting and what practices need to change so that we're able to meet that deadline. So if we pass this bill, we can equip MDE with solid data to use in their training to schools and in their enforcement practices so that families and the general public can really feel confident that the information that is made available to them is accurate. Now, once we get that information about whether our students who have the greatest needs are getting the funding allocated to them, then we could go on to make other determinations, such as providing additional resources in more targeted ways. We can examine which schools are effectively serving students and how they're using their resources wisely. So it's clear that our current progressive state funding formula really matters, and we should protect it, and we need to have a clear picture of to what extent those funds are serving the students they're intended to help. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Loon, did you want to?
Well, Madam Chair, I note that Mr. Nobles is in the audience. I didn't know if he wanted to say anything or if he was just here to listen. So I know we're short on time today.
He looks like he says he's good there. So member questions, Representative Sandstrom?
Just a quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. On your organization, E4E, can you just tell me a little bit about who comprises this? Are you like a public-private business partnership? Tell me a little bit.
Great question. So we represent 2,000 teachers in the metro area who opt in to join our organization as members. And on the front page of the policy paper there, you can actually see the teachers who authored this paper, which includes teachers in district schools, charter schools, and even we had a teacher who's in an independent school serve on this committee, although this report is focused on public schools.
Madam Chair, so teachers only, no business partnerships, no anything like that?
Correct.
Perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if I'm going to get Mr. Nobles down to the table or not. One of the concerns I have about with this proposal is when the Legislative Audit Commission goes through its process, which it just completed, sorry about that, and identifies topics for the OLA to review. The OLA then has a scoping conversation with stakeholders. So, for instance, I see you ask an interesting question about subsidizing, do low-poverty school students subsidize high poverty schools, but state statute requires traditional public schools to subsidize charter schools. But that's not in this list of topics that the OLA must examine. There's also differences in the services that are mandated. And I know my traditional public school friends would have some questions to ask about that. I don't believe charter schools are required to offer ECFE, early childhood special education. Most of them, if not all, refuse to serve level 3 and 4 special education students, but traditional publics are mandated to do that. So there's differences in revenue based on both mandates and choices that schools are making, but none of that gets surfaced in this list of topics. And so my question is, if we bypass the audit commission and go to a legislative process, does that still have space for the scoping conversations, or is the OLA limited to just what the legislation says?
Representative Lewin?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that might be a good question for the auditor, because I know there are direction given, but it sometimes is a project, again, gets scoped, there may be some adjustments, so I would invite Mr. Nobles to make comment on that.
All right, Mr. Nobles, we're glad to have you here. You got dragged down here anyway.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. When we are given assignments like this, either through the Legislative Audit Commission or directed to do one through legislation such as this, or requested, we certainly want to meet the requirements that are laid out in the law, but we would not be limited by that. I mean, we would endeavor to gather all the information and present it, that which we think is relevant, and sometimes that, for context, or for answering other questions that come up during scoping or during the process of the special review or evaluation, we would certainly pursue.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen, you're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. First, in terms of the revenues, how do you deal with property taxes and where those property taxes come from within a school district, like the properties that generate more property taxes?
Ms. Edison? Madam Chair, Representative, that is a question that I can't answer. I'm not sure how that's calculated in terms of the revenues at the school level, at the district level, but that is something that I would hope that this audit would actually be able to address, and that information about how the districts take the levy referendums or property tax values and assign them to schools would be made more clear, and potentially that we could resolve any differences in how that's calculated across different school districts.
Okay, thank you. And then, as I understand this, I mean, the biggest expense, obviously, in any school is the teachers and their salaries, right? And so the question here, so, and the more senior the teachers, the higher the salaries are going to be. So is this going to get at where teachers choose to work in a district?
Ms. Edison.
Madam Chair, Representative. Part of the audit question is studying how salaries are allocated and how that impacts the available budgets per school. So I do anticipate that will uncover whether or not the seniority of the teachers and their pay and how that impacts the resources that are available to students by school.
Representative Thiessen?
And Madam Chair, I guess the question I would have is, can you do that? Can you make a direct correlation between teacher experience and the salary they're being paid and how effective they are in the classroom?
Ms. Edison.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't think that's a question that this report will seek to address as it relates to effectiveness. What it will seek to uncover is we already know that the most experienced teachers are often working in schools with lower poverty rates, and so we know that the schools with the greatest amount of student needs are often working with the least experienced teachers, and so that in and of itself is an inequity. And so the question becomes, how do schools and principals then account for that in their budgets? And so are they an alternative to a staff-based funding model would be a student
allocation model where the money is allocated directly to the school based on the students, and then a principal from there would be able to determine how to get the best teachers in their school, including hopefully some really high-quality experienced teachers in the schools that need them most.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. And, you know, and I mean, honestly, I actually think getting this information would be fairly useful. You know, we have a $33 million budget deficit in Minneapolis right now, and probably rightly so, but the school board has made some decisions that have fairly seriously impacted schools in my district, which are losing fairly large amounts of money, I think, to be redirected to schools with more challenges, which is a fair thing to do, but I think parents are frustrated that they can't figure out exactly how the funding works, and so more transparency, I think, actually makes sense, but how we scope this out is going to be really, really challenging and difficult, and I hope that we can all kind of work together to think through how that, how we get to the right information that's useful.
Answered last question. I promise. Thanks. Just a quick question. I concur with everything you said. Is this a monthly publication?
Madam Chair, Representative, it is not a monthly publication. This is a yearly publication that our teachers worked on over the last 6 months.
Okay, and then Representative Murphy and I were wondering, how do you fund this? It's a beautiful publication. We're wondering, how do you, if your organization is just over 2,000 teachers, where do you come up with the funding stream? Did you have a bake sale? You know, we're just wondering what happened here.
Great question. Madam Chair, Representative, I am the lead fundraiser for our organization, and so I raise our full budget here from local foundations and individuals, as well as some of our partners and members as well.
All right. Representative Liu, final comments.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm always a believer that more information is a good idea, and these are important things that we need to know, and it's also important as we develop the department as our ESSA compliance plan, and this is going to be required by the federal government, so I think it's important that we get this information, and I would appreciate your support in getting this to state government finance, who wants to see the bill.
All right, so Representative Loon renews her motion that House File 360 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. All right, that's re-referred, and the committee is adjourned.
Hi, what's that? Oh, that's a stock photo, so I'm sure at some point we have to write to that photo. Who is? Okay.